Hello, everyone, and welcome to Module 2 of Advanced Aromatherapy, Therapeutic Application of Essential Oils for Clarity, Health, and Happiness with David Crow, titled An Overview of Aromatherapy. This is your host, Colleen, at the Shift Network. A few reminders, if you have any technical questions, while using the webcast, please type them directly into the message box and be sure to include your email address so we can reply by email. If you haven't joined by webcast and you would prefer to experience the benefits of Maestro in the future, for example, for breakouts at the end of session, then please consult your homepage, your course homepage. There's a button, More Access Numbers, on the right-hand side. If you have any other questions and you're in need of support, please do not hesitate to contact our customer support team by visiting our website at support.theshiftnetwork.com. If you are on Maestro and you need any assistance, please press 5 on your telephone keypad and I will come along and assist you. Note, too, that David will be sharing much material with us weekly. For today, if possible, have Module 1 files ready to open, and also the handouts found under Module 2 on the course homepage. That is it for announcements. So now it's on to the rich material from David as he is traveling today on an airplane.
Welcome to everybody. This is Module 2 of the Advanced Aromatherapy course. And as Colleen has mentioned, this is a recorded class. Since Sarah and I are traveling today, this should probably be the last of the recorded classes. I don't think we'll have any further need for that, but I invite you to continue to send your comments and questions in through the webcast anyway, and you can do that any time during the week. So I know that many people attend the course a bit later and get the audio recordings and the transcripts and take the class at their own time. I just want to mention that the webcast is always open. You can always send questions and comments, and I will get them, even though I won't be on the call, on this particular call, in person. I will still be getting your comments, and I will respond to them. I'd like to mention also that there is another resource, which is the Facebook page, and there's lots of discussion starting up there. Colleen will give you that resource details. And again, just to get us started, I'd like to say thank you very much for joining us and for your interest in this very complex and fascinating world of essential oils. Now, sometimes when we do a class, we go back to the week before to review a few things, and I would like to do that starting off here because there was one file in particular that really deserves a little bit more time and attention and discussion. So if you look at the course page, you will see that you can click on the tab that opens up all the files from last week, and if you would open the file titled Oils as Prana and Chi. Let's take a minute and look at this in a little further detail because we went through it fairly quickly towards the end of class. And this is actually a very important part of the program. Not just this one file, but what this one file represents in terms of classifying the essential oils into therapeutic groups, and as a specific way of studying the essential oils. So if you have that file open now, you can follow along while I give a little bit more commentary. Again, that is oils as prana and chi. Now, we talked briefly about what is chi and what is prana, and for those of you who were not in the Ayurvedic aromatherapy course, this might have been a little bit of a stretch because these are big subjects that need a bit more introduction. So we'll take a little bit more time with it. But what I really wanted to emphasize before we run through this one more time is why do we organize essential oils according to these various groups? And so you can see here that basically we have oils that are classified according to prana and chi, but then they're subdivided into those that are specifically energizing to the mind and brain, or those that are known more for immune enhancing, or those that are more known as respiratory or antimicrobial. But then as we go, we also see that the oils are classified into the esoteric concept of ojas from Ayurvedic medicine and jing from Chinese medicine, and then from Agni and Soma, yin and yang from Chinese medicine, and then into the five elements, and then into the different qualities, and specifically the qualities of consciousness and the qualities, physical qualities of the essential oils. Now, why we classify the oils in this particular system is to help us to learn larger groups of therapeutic functions. Now, the reason that we can do that with essential oils is because many essential oils are actually very similar. They have similar chemistry. They have similar primary compounds. They have a similar fragrance and olfactory notes, and they also have similar therapeutics. And therefore, a lot of oils can be classified into therapeutic groups, and that way we can learn very quickly how to use a wide range of oils. Now, if you are studying at a more advanced level, which we will be doing, a variety of eucalyptus species, for example, we will learn that, yes, there are some differences. Yes, there are some differences between species of fir, between silver fir and grand fir, or species of juniper, or various kinds of conifer oils, or eucalyptus oils is a good example, or different species of frankincense. So one of the things that we will learn fairly quickly, you've already learned this if you looked at your essential oil list that I gave you, is that there are many species of the same genus. What that means is that you can have Eucalyptus globulus, that is the species name from the Eucalyptus genus, but you can also have the species Eucalyptus radiata of the Eucalyptus genus. This is a little botanical language. We'll unpack this as we go. You'll become totally familiar with it. But the question frequently comes, what's the difference and which one should I choose? Well, a lot of times it doesn't really matter. There are some differences, but frequently in these larger therapeutic groupings, what we see is that the oils are somewhat interchangeable and we can also blend them together. Now, that's one of the reasons why we would like to classify oils according to different groups, because we can start to see therapeutic similarities, and that helps us to understand the nature of a lot of different oils very quickly. Now, there's another reason why we can classify oils according to these principles from Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine, and that is that the principles tell us what the oils do. And so we can classify oils in these larger therapeutic groups according to many different systems. And next week, we're going to be classifying the oils according to botanical groups, and we'll see the similarities, for example, of how the flower oils can be used, and we'll see the similarities of how the spice oils can be used, and so forth. And as we do this exercise here at the beginning of this course, what I am presenting is a way to start understanding hundreds of essential oils very quickly and very efficiently into these groups. So if we go through and break this down according to the different terms given to us by Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine, then this will give you a very good introduction to what these oils do. And we can unpack the terms in just a moment. But there's another aspect of this that's very important, specifically for why we classify the oils according to Chinese and Ayurvedic medicine. Now, when you were following me, going through the slideshow about the botany of essential oils, we learned all the different cosmological and terrestrial energies that go into the production of essential oil at a botanical level. In other words, we saw that sunlight is what drives photosynthesis, and so sunlight is a part of all oils, and the moon is also influencing the plant, and the ancient intelligence of the plant's evolutionary immune system, evolutionary immunological intelligence in the DNA is there. We learned that there are all of these elements and energies that are in the essential oils. Now, that's different than starting from the viewpoint of chemistry. Now, chemistry is where most modern aromatherapy training programs tend to focus in terms of understanding these groups, because we can classify these oils in terms of these oils have major monoterpenes, these oils have major esters. That's a different way to classify things, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. We will unpack that a little bit during this program, but in my mind, that's not as interesting as the cosmology of the oils. And it's deficient in one very important way, and that is that just knowing the chemistry doesn't link us back to the intelligence of the plant, and it doesn't link us back to the celestial energies of life that are all going into the plant, that are manifest in the essential oil, that then are relating to those energies and elements inside of us. So chemistry is important, but it doesn't help us to develop a view or a feeling or an awareness of our biological unity with nature. And this is, in my opinion, really the deeper reason to study herbal medicine, because we are using the plants to reconnect with something very fundamental and profound in nature to help nature inside of us. So we can approach it from the reductionistic scientific view of what is the active ingredient in the oil. And there is some of that in this course, and it's important, but it doesn't give us the bigger holistic cosmological awareness of our interconnectedness with everything. So this is why the language of Ayurvedic and Chinese medicine is very important, and that's why I wanted to take just a few more minutes and describe what these terms are, because as we go through the therapeutic applications of the oils, we will also want to understand what they're doing to the five elements inside the body, and what they're doing to our prana and chi, and so forth. And this is something that is much more accessible and directly relevant to us at a feeling level than knowing chemistry. So if I were to tell you that this particular oil has this particular compound in a very high level, and that's considered the active ingredient, and it's known to have these kind of physiological effects at this particular molecular level in this particular system, it gets very complicated. But on the other hand, if you are doing the contemplative aromatherapy practice, which I suggested as a deepening practice, and I hope you've been doing it and enjoying it, you're already aware that inhaling the oils has an effect on our prana and chi. You're already aware that inhaling certain oils that come from roots have more of an earthy fragrance, or those that come from conifers have more of a fresh air kind of sensation. And that's how we can make the study of aromatherapy organoleptic, meaning that we can perceive these energies and elements directly ourselves through our own sense organs. And therefore, we can start to understand how to link the cosmology that is in the oils to the cosmology that's in the body. Let's go through this file here and let me unpack it a little bit more, because now I think you understand the relevance of it. And so now let's look at the practicality of it one more time. Now, all essential oils at some level are related to prana and qi, and I gave you a good definition of both qi and prana, translations of those terms last week, and I am suggesting that this is an ongoing exercise, and people can classify things in different ways, and as we go through and classify things, and we use these systems, I just want to point out that there are many oils where you can see very clear parallels and associations and correspondences. They're very easy to classify, in other words, into this group or into that group. However, there are also many oils that are very difficult to classify in a particular system, and we should not try to become too esoteric about this and put everything in little boxes. This happens often when people say, what oils correspond to what chakras? Well, that's very open to interpretation. There may be a few specific associations we can make, but people have so many different associations with what chakras are and perceive the oils in different ways, and it's very, very hard to say, well, this is like that. However, there are some systems where you can see clear associations and where those associations work, and they help us to understand something, then we should use this system of classifying things, and otherwise, let's not be overly concerned about it. So I gave you some specific justifications of why I classify the first group of oils according to being energizing to the mind and the brain. Rosemary helps with memory and recall, and it's a mental stimulant. Laurel is a warming spice that smells kind of like cinnamon, and it's antidepressant and mood uplifting and boosts the immune system. And it's energizing to the mind and the brain. Now, the tulsi oil is extracted from the tulsi herb, and the tulsi herb is one of the herbs that's renowned in Ayurveda for supporting the prana of the brain and the nervous system. And so if we're extracting that and breathing it, we can also give a pretty good justification that tulsi essential oil is going to be stimulant to the mind and the brain. Now we come to the next part, which is the definition of prana and qi as immunity, and this is very important. Well, how many essential oils boost our immunity? Well, practically all of them at some level could. For example, lavender has some antimicrobial effects that can help fight off colds and flus, but at the same time, lavender is very relaxing, and getting a good night of sleep can also boost our immune system. So we can say that lots and lots of oils can fit in here, but we want to narrow it down to those that are connected directly to prana and qi as concepts, and frankincense and tulsi are two that I would say are the most clear examples. Now, prana and qi are also connected to our breathing and respiratory system, and therefore I would choose all the eucalyptus species and all the species of conifers and the tulsi again. And we also see that prana and qi as an aspect of immunity are also is also the concept of what fights off the pathogens. So in other words, if we have qi deficiency, according to Chinese medicine, specifically the type of qi that's called wei qi, our protective qi, then we have a tendency to get colds and flus easily. If our prana is low, our immune system is low. And therefore, that's when we have a tendency to use some of the stronger antimicrobials. And the antimicrobials are tea tree, oregano, ravintsar, and tulsi. What other essential oils are known to have antimicrobial powers? Well, practically all of them have some research confirming that if you put them in a petri dish against a particular strain of microbe, that it generally will have some kind of effect. Now, you can see here that all of these functions overlap, that most likely the oils that are going to be energizing to the mind and brain are also going to be things that are strengthening through the respiratory system and vice versa. And so we can see that the conifers and the eucalyptus oils are also known not just for decongestant expectorant effects in the respiratory system and good for treating colds and flus, but they're also very well known for giving the mind clarity, basically sharpening the concentration and increasing alertness. So these things all overlap, and these are all different aspects of prana and chi. Now, the concept of ojas is a little bit more complicated. I'll just touch on it again. It's basically the nutrient essence. Okay, so how do we know the ojas in the body? We touched on this in the 7-week program. It's basically the end result of all of the metabolic stages of our food, and it's basically what gives our immune system its strength and stability, and the light in the eyes and the complexion of the skin and the radiance of the aura and so forth. Now, this is a little bit of a more esoteric concept to try to translate into the oils, but what we can see is that certain heartwood oils that are sweet, like sandalwood and agarwood and cedarwood, could be classified as being the end result of a long metabolic process of extracting nutrients to build up the core energy of the plant to protect it, and that's what these oils do. Now, the reason that we want to classify things like this is so we can understand what to do with these oils. So we have a way to apply them therapeutically, and therefore, if we understand that eucalyptus and conifer oils are very rich in prana and chi that relates directly to our respiratory system, then these will be the first oils that we'll reach for when we start treating respiratory conditions. And likewise, we can understand that if we're using sandalwood oil to anoint ourselves with, that it will have a nourishing effect on our ojas, and our ojas is that which is strengthened by deep relaxation and meditation. So we can start to connect some dots there therapeutically. Now, the flowers basically represent the reproductive essence, and the reproductive essence in Chinese medicine is called jing, and ojas is also very closely related to reproductive essence, and reproductive essence is also linked to the idea of soma, which is basically the lunar nectar. So it's very difficult to classify a lot of the flower oils in terms of the five elements. Are they mostly air, mostly water, mostly fire? Well, when I ask this question in a large group, everybody gives different answers. But on the other hand, almost everybody can kind of intuitively feel and sense when they smell floral oils that there's a connection to the moon. Not just the biorhythm of the moon itself, but to the concept that the moon is that which has a strong influence on the water element in plants. So the sun as Agni, hot and dry, the moon as soma, moist and cooling. And moist and cooling elements are found primarily in the flowers. And so when we come to the classification of the flower oils next week, we're going to learn that the flower oils are yin as opposed to the spice oils that are yang. And if they're yin, we can therefore say that they're more connected to the moon. Now, what does this have to do with anything? Well, we're looking for therapeutic benefits. So when do we use yin, cool, mostly relaxing, calming, and somewhat hydrating types of oils? Well, we use those when we have conditions of excess yang. That's the same principle as we go through here. Now we come to yang and agni. And this is very important because this group of oils, as we'll learn next week, the hot, spicy, stimulant oils are the most dangerous in terms of potential side effects. So here's a list. And it's not just the spice oils, it's also the citrus oils, which can be very phototoxic. You put them on your skin, you go out in the sun, you'll get burned later. And this fire element principle of agni and sunlight, very, very crucial to understand in terms of protecting ourselves from harm from the essential oils. But it also links to what do these oils do therapeutically. Well, they're stimulants. They're digestive stimulants. All you have to do is smell them and they'll stimulate your appetite. They're circulatory stimulants, metabolic stimulants, and so forth. And there are ways that they can be used. Now, just to wrap this up here, we now go into the classification of the five elements. this is a good exercise to understand that many oils are more related to air element. Well, what does that mean? They're more connected to the respiratory system. We use them for purifying the atmosphere. And now when we classify the oils according to the five elements, we can also start to see some practical applications in terms of safety. And so generally the air element oils have a tendency to have a relatively low dermatoxic potential. In other words, you can rub eucalyptus oil on your chest in the shower, and it's not going to burn you, whereas some of the fire element oils will. And if you go down to the next list, you'll see that lemongrass is very spicy and can burn the skin, and cinnamon leaf and birch, wintergreen. These oils have a very high potential of dermotoxicity. And then all the citruses, very high potential for phototoxicity. Therefore, we have to understand that these oils, even though the citruses are sweet and relaxing, and otherwise the fruit is cooling and hydrating, the essential oils are not. The essential oils are extremely dangerous, actually. Then when we come to the water element, we see that there's practically no essential oils that actually are hydrating. There are maybe three possible examples: rose oil, sandalwood oil, vetiver oil. And all the other oils, the essential oils, are basically drying to the skin. And so what do we say then in the world of aromatherapy as far as water element? Well, that's where we have carrier oils that we will discuss in this class, and hydrosols, the aromatic waters that you saw coming out of the still in the slideshow last week. And those represent actual aromatic products that are hydrating. Hydrosols are hydrating to the skin. Carrier oils are used as the base for essential oils, and carrier oils are hydrating. Now, to complete the five elements, you see that there are many oils that can be easily classified as being related to the earth element. And why is that? Well, many of them come from roots. For example, Jatamansi, the Himalayan spikenard oil. It smells like dirt. It smells like a root, or the mitti from Ayurveda. It's distilled mud. It's actually the fragrance of the earth. And you can also see that some of the wood oils, like cedar oil and sandalwood oil, very rich in earth element, because the oil is not just concentrated in the heartwood, it's also concentrated in the roots. And what does this mean therapeutically? The earth element oils have a tendency to be those that are very stabilizing, calming, sort of heavy, viscous, unctuous, and so forth. So we can see some clear associations now. Now, just to continue with the last section, we can also classify the oils according to their effect on the qualities of our consciousness. So there's two systems that are called gunas. This is just a review for those of you who are in the Ayurvedic aromatherapy, and a quick introduction for those of you who are not. Gunas means qualities, and there's three qualities of consciousness, 20 qualities of matter. So we start with what oils are very good for helping spiritual consciousness, meaning sattvic consciousness. And this is where we have those oils that are basically in the classification that I like to call the sacred scents: sandalwood and agarwood and frankincense and palo santo and cistus, the rock rose and rose. These are things that are very supportive of spiritual consciousness, that have a long history of use in ritual and ceremonies. Then we look at rajasic, or aggressive, aggravated, irritated, angry consciousness, agitated consciousness. Then we can see that one of the primary antidotes is the cooling flowers, because rajasic tends to be associated with overstimulation of heat in the body, in the mind, in the emotions. And the flowers are more yin, more rich in soma moonlight, more cooling. And then we can see that we can classify the oils from prana and the five elements to overcome tamasic consciousness, or dullness and inertia. And that's where we see that the hot stimulant oils can be used. Now, there are 20 major gunas of matter that are described, and these are classified in Ayurvedic medicine as 10 pairs: hot and cold, dry and moist, slow and fast, light and heavy, and so forth. These 10 that are outlined here are the 10 that I personally find to be the most relevant to essential oils. Again, we can't always classify things and put everything in a nice little box, but sometimes we can. And so I have found that there are oils that are good examples of the quality of heaviness, and some that are good examples of the quality of lightness, and some that are good examples of hot and cold and moist and dry and dense and flowing and dull and sharp. Those pairs seem to be the ones that are the most obvious in terms of classification. Now, if we take all of these things and we put it all together, you can see that just in this one file, you have learned a tremendous amount about how to use large groups of oils according to Ayurvedic and Chinese terms with practical therapeutic applications, and you can also start to see how they overlap. You start to see that fire element oils tend to be classed as being rich in Agni and Yang, and these tend to be stimulant for tamasic, dull conditions of the mind and so forth. All right. This concludes our little overview then of that particular file. I hope you found that helpful, because we're going to continue with this kind of thinking next week when we do this exercise with the botanical classifications. And by the time we get done with that, you'll have a really good overview of a lot of oils as a basic starting point. Then what we do is we start to unpack that in the specific therapeutic classifications. Now, let's look at another file that is in this week's collection. So if you will go back to the course page and click on the link that opens up the files for this week, there is a file that is titled The Most Important Essential Oils for the Home Pharmacy. So let's take a moment and find that. Now, I know that everybody's anxious to start using the oils and start learning about what they do. And at the same time, there's so many big subjects that we have to introduce first about the safety of the oils and the problems in the essential oil industry and quality control and all of that, which is our topic for today. We have to cover all of these things before we get into the deeper levels, but at the same time, we can also start getting prepared and starting to look at what oils would you like to have. That was the file I gave you last week, the essential oil list. And this is an addition to that. This is another file that basically outlines what I would consider to be some of the most practical, most effective, most predictable, most widely used oils for having in the home. And so this is a good introduction to some of the major oils that we will be studying in some detail, but this is something we can just take a minute with and look over quickly. Excuse me for a second. Okay, now, number one, lavender. Well, lavender is the world's number one selling essential oil. It's very gentle. It has a low dermotoxic potential. It's basically a mild calmative relaxant with immune-enhancing antimicrobial powers. It's a remedy for burns. It helps kids with concentration and learning. And a little note here, I would consider lavender as an equivalent to what we call an adaptogenic herb. In other words, the adaptogenic herbs are those that help us to cope with stress. They help us to adapt. They help to balance our system in such a way that we can adapt to difficult circumstances. And I think it meets that criteria. We'll explore that more when we get to this specific oil. But lavender helps strengthen the body. It harmonizes the immune system, neurological system, endocrine system. It's got functions that work on all three of those systems. It's got a big range, a wide range of therapeutic functions, and you will receive a monograph on that very shortly. Okay, I mentioned this in the file, but it's not posted yet. It will be shortly. Number two oil, very important, is helichrysum, and specifically the Helichrysum metallicum species This is the most important oil for wound healing, skin regeneration, resolving scar tissues, anti-inflammatory, blood vitalizing, bruise resolving, and it also has some antimicrobial powers. So this is a good one to keep around. I've heard just countless testimonials of people who have cut themselves, injured themselves, recovering from surgeries, all kinds of things. Helichrysum is very predictable. A lot of oils are not predictable. They're very subjective because they're actually working on the limbic system through the sense of smell. Helichrysum works directly on the tissues. We don't have to smell it. It just goes to work on the circulatory system and the skin and the muscles. Number three, Jatamansi. This is the Himalayan spikenard. It's definitely one of the most psychoactive of the oils. It gives undoubted results, very repetitious, expected results for dreaming, chronic insomnia, deep-seated traumas, high vata, overstimulation of the nervous system, and so forth. So these oils require a little bit more information about how to use them and when to use them. This is just an introduction to get you interested in the oils, and very shortly we're going to start learning how to use them. But if you're interested in having these, then this is just a little heads up that these are important things that you might want to purchase for your collection. So, frankincense are many species of frankincense in the Boswellia genus. It comes both as oil and as the tears, which are burned in ceremony and ritual. Very evocative of spiritual moods, meaning that it helps to relax anxiety. It's antidepressant, has very significant anti-inflammatory powers, bruise resolving, blood vitalizing, a great medicine, again, for scar tissue, wound healing, and so forth. Also very good for the respiratory system. Has a multitude of benefits. There are some studies that have become very famous about some of the compounds in frankincense having anti-tumor benefits. It's actually one of the myths about frankincense that I'm going to unpack. There's some truth to it, but the actual marketing material that's being generated from it is a little bit overblown. Next, the respiratory oils. This is actually a group of oils as opposed to a specific oil. And these would be the conifers and the eucalyptus oils, those that are very rich in air element that we just got done talking about. And then number six is a group of antimicrobials, starting with tea tree, which you have to be careful about on the skin because it can be burned. Niuli, which is a different species of Melaleuca, which is the genus of tea tree. And then Manuka, which is the lemon-scented tea tree. And so this is a group of very strong antimicrobials that you might want to think about having. And then finally, one of my favorites, and also a favorite of many people, and that's Palo Santo. This is one of the sacred scents. It comes from a tree in South America. There's a lot to say about it, but it's very, very purifying and antidepressant and anti-anxiety. All right, there is a quick overview of some of the important oils that you would like to have. And now we can jump into our module. Today, we have a lot of things to talk about, the overview of aromatherapy. And the theme of this module is that although the use of aromatic plants is ancient, the use of essential oils is a relatively modern development, and because of their extremely concentrated nature, essential oils must be used with a high level of knowledge and caution to avoid causing adverse reactions. When used safely, aromatherapy can support health and wellness in numerous important ways. So what are the main topics that we will cover? They're listed here on the sales page, actually, the outline of the course. In the next hour or so, we're going to cover the differences between medical and non-medical aromatherapy, and that will include some discussion about what you can and cannot do with the information from this course. We're going to talk about some of the difficult quality control issues in the essential oil industry. I'm going to dispel some of the myths and fraudulent claims about essential oils. We're going to talk about toxicity and adverse reactions. We're going to talk about essential oils and other forms, the differences between essential oils and other forms of herbal medicine. We're going to talk about safe and unsafe uses of essential oils and also introduce carrier oils into aromatic waters. Now, why do we want to do all of this? Why is this important? Why can't we just start studying essential oils and how to use them? Well, because the industry is very complicated and it's very corrupt. There's a lot of contamination of the oils. There's a lot of fraudulent claims, and there's a lot of people getting hurt. I would have to say that of all the aspects of herbal medicine that I am familiar with as an herbalist, as a professional educator in the field of natural medicine, that the incidence of injury and adverse reactions is astounding when it comes to essential oils and aromatherapy compared to other adverse reactions from other kinds of herbs. Now, let's unpack this a little bit. As I mentioned last week, one of my primary goals is to protect you from misinformation, fraudulent claims, and therefore to protect all of us from adverse reactions. So what is aromatherapy? I gave you a brief definition of that in the last class. Therapy from aromas. But the important thing to remember here is that not all aromas are therapeutic. There's lots of aromas, and a lot of those aromas actually smell pretty good, but they come from toxic products, and that's the difficulty with the aromatherapy industry, is that there's so much overlap between industries. Let's keep in mind something I told you last week in the slideshow, and that is that the majority of essential oils do not move into aromatherapy channels. They go into industry channels. They go into the pharmaceutical industry for flavoring drugs. They go into the food industry for flavoring foods. They go into the cosmetic industry for fragrancing of cosmetics. They go to the perfume industry for fragrancing in perfumes. Now, if you understand the pharmaceutical industry and its sources, and the food industry and its sources, and the perfume industry and its sources, you will know that the majority of ingredients that go into those channels are not from natural sources. There's a huge amount of synthetic aroma compounds that go into the food industry and that go into the fragrance industry. Now, those synthetic compounds cross over with the supply chains in these particular industries, and so a lot of what ends up coming out the other end and coming to us from pure sources of essential oils are not. There's a lot of industrial products that make it into the aromatherapy world. I'm sorry to report this to you, but this is why we have to be very careful. We need to get our oils directly from the distillers. We can't get our oils from large brokers. And the main problem is that the bigger a company gets, the more difficult it is to get high-quality oils from small artisan distillers. And you then have to go to the brokers, and when you go to the brokers, brokers are buying large amounts of things and diluting them and passing them on and adding things and passing them on, and that's why there is such a high degree of contamination. Now let's unpack the question here. What are the differences between medical and non-medical aromatherapy? This is how I define this particular issue, okay? And this is very, very relevant to knowing what level of information this course is related to. Unpacking this particular question of what is medical and what is non-medical in terms of treatment is extremely relevant politically, as I will explain in a moment, and it's very relevant to you not hurting yourself or not hurting others. So the main problem is that there's a lot of confusion about how to use essential oils in a therapeutic way that is not medical versus people trying to use essential oils for treating medical conditions without the proper background. Now, the main thing that we should all understand is that there are widespread injuries that are happening on an ongoing basis because of lack of education on how to use essential oils safely. Now, this is a medical problem, but it's also political, economic, and social. And so where does it come from? Well, it's coming because of the primary way that essential oils have come into the United States, specifically. Now, I mentioned this last week. In Europe, essential oils have been in the public awareness for quite some time because they came out of the base of agriculture. In other words, in the south of France, they've been distilling lavender oil for well over 100 years, probably more. For what? For the perfume industry. But in the last 50 or 60 years, there's been a lot of emphasis on, well, it's not just for perfume, it also has some therapeutic benefits. So essential oils have been around for a long time in Europe, and education about them has been around for a long time in a medical context. Now, we can compare that and contrast that with the way that most people have been introduced to essential oils in the United States, and that is they've come into public awareness primarily through multi-level marketing. Now, what I mentioned, the positive side of this, is that this has introduced a huge number of people to aromatherapy. The negative side is that multi-level marketing is driven by the need to sell oils, and it is not in the context of a clinical education or in the context of the pharmaceutical use of the oils. Now, why has this become so successful? This is actually not a problem with multi-level marketing. Multi-level marketing is just it's just a business model, that's all. But why has it become so problematic? Why are so many people being injured by essential oils? To the point where I believe that if we don't get this under control, that the regulatory agencies will step in, and they already are. So the reason that multi-level marketing has been so successful with essential oils is because there's a vacuum in our society of natural medicine. And there's also widespread economic financial stress that people are having. So there's basically two big social problems that we're having, and multi-level marketing has stepped into this vacuum of things that are missing that, as Americans, we should be seeing our tax dollars spent on giving us high-quality medical care and uplifting our economic situation. So people get involved with multi-level marketing because they're promised that they're going to make a lot of money. But in order to make a lot of money, you have to sell a lot of essential oils. And in order to sell a lot of essential oils, you have to tell people to do all kinds of things that are unwise to get them to consume them. So let's look at what's missing in our society here. Why has this problem really become so magnified? We don't have a well-established holistic healthcare system in our society. And that basically leaves people with only limited allopathic modern medical options. And people are desperate for medical help. That's what's feeding this. And people are also desperate for some economic support. And so we find ourselves in a situation where we have three sources of medical information available to us. And the first is conventional pharmaceutical medicine. That means our modern allopathic clinics, our hospitals. Now, in that system, there are many doctors who are very open-minded about holistic and natural alternatives, but many are not. And many try to frighten their patients, discourage them from using things that are very beneficial. And so it's problematic then to only have access to allopathic medicine. Now, should we only have allopathic medicine? No. Allopathic medicine does not do two primary things. It does not offer nutritional rejuvenative medicine to make us stronger, and it does not offer detoxification medicine to purify. So, therefore, allopathic medicine has some serious limitations in treating illness. And I think that most people are aware of that. Even most doctors are aware of that at this point. It has very important functions. And for some things, you don't want to go anywhere else. But when it comes to chronic degenerative conditions and low immunity and things coming from poor nutrition, things related to stress, so many different things, you don't need to take a pharmaceutical prescription a lot of times. You need something natural. And there's a vast overconsumption of prescription medications that can easily be avoided by just having a healthier diet and using natural medicine. Now, the second source of medical information is if you can connect with a good medical practitioner, a holistic practitioner, like holistic MD or a naturopath or a chiropractor or acupuncturist, a trained herbalist. But a lot of times these people are not that accessible. For example, a lot of times most of the practitioners are in urban areas, and the real problem is that insurance doesn't cover natural medicine. That's the real crime that's happening socially. Insurance should be covering natural medicine. Even for their own good, they would save money if they covered natural medicine, because they would help avoid more insurance bills by reducing illness. So this puts people in the position of having to pay out of pocket to a cash practice, and that's what really limits people in terms of getting high-quality holistic medicine. And the really good holistic practitioners are frequently booked up a long time in advance also. Unfortunately, what that means is that holistic medicine has become kind of a luxury for wealthy people. And this is not how it should be. Now, what about everybody else? That's the majority of people in the country who are looking for alternatives. Modern medicine has failed them. And where are they going to go? They're going to go to the internet. Okay, well, the internet has some good things and bad things about it, and there's basically two forms of internet information here that we find useful. One is the science, and the other is the marketing. And this is where it's all mixed up, because there's aggressive marketing. Buy these oils, incredible exaggerated claims, not enough education about how to use them safely. But at the same time, if you dig around, you're going to find a lot of good science about this as well. So that's what we have to take apart. All right. Now, I just want to mention that recently the FDA had to step in and give warnings to the two large multi-level marketing companies that are out there, because their reps, they were trained to make these outrageous claims that these essential oils will cure cancer, they will cure Ebola. Well, this is fraudulent, and it's unethical, and it's dangerous, and it's not even reality-based, all right? And that's why I'm taking some time to unpack this for you, because this is a big political aspect of essential oils that could threaten the availability of essential oils if this continues on like this, all right? Now, even with those warnings, people are continuing to propagate these outrageous claims. And with those claims comes the risk of hurting people. And now let's look at this. How does this happen? All right. Here we can touch on the point, the differences between essential oils and other forms of herbal medicine. Now, what people are not understanding, what people are being told fraudulently, is that essential oils can just be used for this and that. But people are not being told, well, where do essential oils come from? What are they? Essential oils are the most concentrated form of herbal medicine. Now, the basic question I'll ask here before I unpack it is, if you are using herbal medicine, do you need an education? Well, for a simple home pharmacy, no, you don't need extensive information. How educated do you need to be to understand that if you chop up a ginger root and make tea with it, that it's going to be good for your cold and flu? You don't need much education, but that's a ginger root. How about taking turmeric? Do you need a medical degree? No. So this is where we have to separate medical from non-medical. And this is what we could classify as grassroots healthcare, home pharmacy, folk medicine. Everybody should know folk medicine. Everybody should know home pharmacy. But certain herbs are very strong. And so therefore, should just everybody know all kinds of semi-toxic herbs without more education? No, you need more education to understand things beyond the level of food-grade herbs. Well, when you get to essential oils, you're talking about the most concentrated form of herbal medicine, and yet the majority of people who are telling people to use essential oils do not have an herbal medical training background. Now, let's visualize this. We can say that it's a pyramid of concentration, a potency of the substance, and it's also a corresponding pyramid of educational requirements. So these are the differences between essential oils and other forms of herbal medicine. So at the beginning, at the base of the pyramid, we can visualize the five elements. This is nature, all right? So what are the five elements? It's the soil, it's the sunlight, it's the water, and these are the oldest elements used by humans forever for healing. In other words, we start with nature cure. What is that? Mud bath therapy, sweat lodge, the hot stones in the sweat lodge, bathing in mineral springs, sunbathing. That's the five elements. That's the most fundamental level. So even at that level, you can see dramatic cures. And even at that level, you can see you need to have some education. You can hurt yourself in a sweat lodge. You can become dehydrated and pass out. Let's go to the next level of this pyramid. Moving up from the five elements, we come to foods. And this is basically the interface between agriculture and the health of the food chain and the health of families and society. Now, how much education do you need to have a healthy diet? You need a fair amount, actually. You need to understand what's happening in agriculture. You need to understand what foods are good for you and what are not, what foods are good for your body type, what foods have potential to cause reactions, maybe gluten. You need to understand about sugar. There's a fair amount of education that is lacking in our society even here at this particular level. Now we move up the pyramid and it becomes a little more specialized, and that's where we start to see what's called food-grade herbs. Okay, these are known as pot herbs. These would be things like burdock root and nettles and a lot of the aromatic herbs that we get from our garden and things like that that are used in soups and cooking, all right? And these are things you need to know a little bit about, but you don't have to have a medical degree. But then we go to the next level, which are the mild medicinal plants, and that will include making stronger teas out of the spices and herbs. And so that's where, you know, you start to learn about, you make a ginger tea, you put your tulsi in it, you can use cinnamon in certain ways to help your digestion, maybe stabilize your blood sugar. These are mild medicinal plants, but you still need education about them. And then we go to the moderately strong medicinal plants, and then we come to the very potent herbs. And this is at the level of naturopathic, highly qualified herbal training. You shouldn't just be taking certain kinds of herbs because they're going to make you throw up. They're going to give you diarrhea. They're going to overstimulate your heart. There's a lot of those herbs that are out there that you don't know about because they're in the realm of specialized herbal medicine. Now, we keep going up the pyramid. It keeps getting stronger, and that's because we come to extracting methods. And so we see that the primary extracting methods in herbal medicine are tinctures, which are alcohol extracts, which increase the potency even more. And finally, we come to the most concentrated form of herbal medicine at the very top of the pyramid, and that is essential oils. So, welcome to the top of the concentration pyramid, essential oils. Now, people need to know about their diet. How much education does it take to have a healthy diet? Quite a bit. How much education does it take to really understand home pharmacy? It's simple at one level. It's relatively safe. You're not going to hurt yourself, but the more you know, the better the results. And then how about when you get into the stronger herbs? You need a fair amount of education. And then when you get into the tinctures, you can't just be drinking tinctures. You need to know precise doses. Then you come to essential oils. Well, with tinctures, the doses generally run from about 10 drops to 30 drops. And even if you take 50 drops, most herbal tinctures that are easily available aren't going to hurt you. They're not going to cause any kind of adverse reaction. But now, suddenly, at the very top, we see essential oils that people are being told to take internally. Now, there is a very fine line between the effect of one drop of oregano oil on your tongue and three drops of oregano oil on your tongue. That's how concentrated essential oils are. Therefore, we can now link this pyramid of concentration to the pyramid of education. And what I will say here is that if you are selling products that are the most concentrated form of herbal medicine, and you do not have an education beyond multi-level marketing weekends, then you are potentially telling people, in a very high likelihood, telling people things that are unsafe. And it's not going to feel good if someone comes back to you and says, "You told me to put this essential oil on my child and it burned them. And a month later, they're still burned." Okay, this happens. So there are many challenges to applying essential oils to medical conditions. And this is where we have to separate medical versus non-medical. I am mostly going to be teaching you non-medical aromatherapy, but there are some areas where we will cross over into safe medical applications. But the bottom line is, you must understand that essential oils are not biocompatible. Why is that? Well, they're volatile compounds. They're very unstable. They evaporate. They're not water soluble. They're potentially toxic in small doses. And so, therefore, they're not something we should just be putting randomly on our skin or putting randomly in our mouth. Now, because of the highly concentrated nature of essential oils, even small doses can cause adverse reactions, both on the skin or in the GI tract, or, to continue on, in the liver and the brain. So there's also a huge difference between the research showing that essential oils do something in a petri dish and having the knowledge and information about how to apply that. There's a very narrow margin between a safe therapeutic dose and a toxic dose, and there's incompatibility with the tissues. Now, what I will say is that essential oils are being very closely analyzed by the pharmaceutical industry and laboratories looking for ways to overcome these problems because they have great potential. But drinking them is not the answer. Now, we have some paradoxes here. They're pharmaceutical strength, and they can cause serious adverse reactions. On the other hand, they can be safe and easy to use for almost everyone. Therefore, we have to separate these two forms of medicine, home pharmacy versus clinical aromatherapy. And the problem is that people are trying to treat medical conditions without sufficient education, and that lack of education is so bad, so fundamental, that people are being told that their signs of poisoning and adverse reactions are detox. All right, I'm going to unpack that again in just a minute. Now, what can you do with this information? Many of you are probably wondering, all right, what can I do with essential oils? So I'm going to tell you exactly what the scope of practice is for this course. If you are a licensed healthcare practitioner, like a naturopathic doctor, an MD, a chiropractor, and so forth, you can use essential oils in your clinic as part of holistic treatments, with minimal legal risk. It's probably not covered under your scope of practice, but you can probably do it in a highly educated way to where you don't run into trouble. Now, if you're a massage therapist, you can't practice medicine, but you can incorporate them into your massage oils. You can use them in diffusers and so forth. Now, if you do not have a medical license, you cannot diagnose or prescribe. That's where the multi-level marketing has really become problematic, is that you have all these reps that are out there who are diagnosing and prescribing. You cannot do that. Now, aromatherapy certification, this is a big question. What does certification do or not do? It doesn't do anything. It's just proof that you have taken an educational course, okay? And there's higher levels of certification. Some require 250 hours, some require 500 hours. It doesn't mean anything medically. An aromatherapist cannot diagnose or prescribe. That's all there is. And this is the primary reason that so many of the multi-level marketing reps got into trouble with the FDA. And personally, if I was one of those reps and I had been told that you can put this on your website, you can make these claims, and then the FDA had called me up, I would be upset. So let's just make sure that if you are practicing aromatherapy and you are not a medical practitioner, you're not making any claims that you're treating Alzheimer's, you're treating cancer, that these oils are going to do this or that, just stay away from all of that. Now, on the other hand, what's paradoxical, everybody in this course can use essential oils following safety guidelines, and you're going to get therapeutic benefits from it. Just as long as you don't go out and start saying that you're treating something and diagnosing something. All right, I hope that's helpful. It is a complicated subject. It's very important because I want to protect you from running into any problems, not just hurting yourself, but hurting others, which might be even worse. And I don't want you to get in trouble with the FDA. This is a real hot subject now. The FDA is real aware of it. They're watching all of this. So let's be responsible. And I would like to ask everybody in this course, be responsible, be proactive, help to dispel some of this problem that's happening. Help to re-educate people about this. This is our responsibility to herbal medicine. Now, there's a lot of myths. There's a lot of fraudulent claims about essential oils. There's a lot of misinformation, disinformation. Why? Because people aren't getting proper education. That's all. And because of the combination of lack of education and needing to sell essential oils through multi-level marketing channels, there's all kinds of things that are being passed around. And this is where I hold the multi-level marketing companies responsible for actually making fraudulent statements and passing that on to their reps. And so now I'm going to unpack some of these things, because you must understand that a lot of what you've heard about essential oils is not true. And this will also help to answer many of your questions in advance. These are questions that come up over and over and over and over about essential oils and aromatherapy. What about this and what about that? Now I'm going to answer all your questions. So first of all, there is a term that has been coined by the multi-level marketing companies called therapeutic grade essential oils. And so this is probably one of the most common questions that I hear. Are your oils therapeutic grade? There's no such thing. There is no such thing as a therapeutic grade. Why? Because there's no such grading system. There's no such grading system which says this oil is therapeutic and this oil is not therapeutic. An essential oil is either pure or it's not. That's all you have to know. Now, there's another myth that's closely connected to that, which is only my company sells therapeutic grade oils. Well, that's not true. Essential oil companies sell essential oils, all right? An essential oil, if it's a pure oil, will be therapeutic. If it's contaminated, it'll be problematic. Now, let's look at another big question. What do you think of this company or that company in terms of their quality? Well, here's the reality. The bigger the company gets, the more it has to depend on brokers that are dealing with oils that come from these supply chains that cross over into fragrancing and flavoring industries, and therefore the bigger your company gets, the more difficulty you have getting pure essential oils, and the more likely you're going to end up with something toxic. Now, as a small company, our solution is, if we can't get something from one of our extended family distillers, it's out of stock. We're not going to try to go to a broker where we can get something that's sold as lavender oil, knowing that 60% of lavender oil is adulterated on the market. Now, that doesn't mean that all companies are either good or bad. Here's the most important thing to understand. This will answer countless questions. It is not the company that determines the quality of the oil. It's the species of the oil that matters. So therefore, when you have an oil that's extremely rare, that's in high demand, what do you think happens? Last year, the rose crop in Bulgaria was seriously damaged by climate change. What do you think happened to the price of rose oil and the availability of rose oil? It skyrocketed. What do you think happened to the industry? A huge amount of synthetic rose oil has come out to replace a lot of the true rose oil that isn't available anymore. So when it comes to oils that are very high cost, that are more rare, that are produced in smaller amounts, coming from endangered species like sandalwood, and when those things are in high demand, you can always be sure there's a very high likelihood that what you are buying is contaminated. So one of my mentors in India is a chemist who analyzes thousands of samples of sandalwood all year long. And he told me directly, personally, he said that almost every sample of sandalwood oil that he tests for other companies in India is contaminated. That's the degree of seriousness. Now, why does this become important? Because if somebody's telling you to take an essential oil internally, and that oil is generally contaminated on the market, you're running into some pretty high risk of potentially taking some synthetic toxins instead of a true essential oil. So this is a big subject. Now, here's another one. This is an amusing myth, actually, and that is, oils have vibrations. Well, this is an old myth that's been floating around for a while. And this, of course, was created by one of the multi-level marketing companies. And it seems to also be linked to sales of these meters to measure the vibration of your oil. But this has been debunked many times by various scientists. And basically what it reveals is a profound lack of understanding of science. And the claim that's made is that an oil can be classed according to a particular radio frequency. Well, that's just wrong. It's totally off base from a scientific standpoint. Now, a specific molecule has a vibration, but it's not measured in radio frequencies. It can be measured with infrared, and it's far, far above, billions and trillions of times above the frequency of radio signals, megahertz. But an essential oil is not one molecule. An essential oil is hundreds of molecules, all right? So this entire claim is not true, all right? Now, here's another one. This is really important. A pure oil will not cause adverse reactions. This is dangerous. A pure oil has the potential to cause many toxic reactions. This is closely related to the false claim that I just made. The false claim I just pointed out, which is that essential oils help you to detox. So let's unpack that for a minute. This, in my opinion, is a statement that is a public health hazard. People are told to put essential oils directly on their skin. They're told to put essential oils directly on the skin of their children. People start to notice that they're developing a rash. We're going to look at some adverse reaction reports here in a minute. Skin starts to become irritated. It starts to develop blisters. It starts to spread. It starts to burn. Children start to cry. It's not a pretty picture. They go back to the rep. The rep tells them, that's detoxification. It's good. This is fraudulent. This is dangerous. This is criminal. This is malpractice. When a person is being burned by an essential oil, it is not a detoxification reaction. It's called dermotoxicity. If it burns a GI tract, it's not a detoxification reaction. It's called internal toxicity. Let's be very, very clear about that. Now, closely related to all of this, especially the claim that a pure oil will not cause adverse reactions, is another claim that if you are a company that puts "do not use externally or take internally" on the label, it means that it's a low-quality oil. Well, how's that for marketing genius? That means that you have just told everyone that every company who is being responsible and safe is basically selling low-quality oils. Brilliant. Now, let's look at another one here, and that is, if you have a chromatograph of the oil, it means it's a pure oil. All right, now, if you look at the files, please, you'll see a file called GC. You can go ahead and open that up, and I'm just going to take a minute to explain a little bit of chemistry to you. A chromatograph is done by putting one drop of essential oil into an analytical machine that basically spreads the oil out in a coil. It vaporizes it into a gas. It circulates it through a coil, and it comes out the other end of the tube, and it passes through an ionizing flame after a certain period of time. So if you look at the graph here, what you see is the time that goes along the bottom, and you see the concentration that goes up and down. This breaks an essential oil apart into its various components. And so this is an example of a sample that was sent to us. And so you can see here the percentages. You can see percentage of pinene and camphene and myrcene and so forth. And people are being told, well, we have a chromatograph of our oil, and therefore it means it's pure. Well, scroll through this. Take a look. You tell me, is this oil pure or not? All right, I think you get my point. You need a chemist to translate this. You can't read this, and just because the company told you that they have the chromatograph doesn't mean anything. This is a sample of a highly contaminated product. It's full of synthetic fragrance chemicals. All right, let's just put that aside, and what I'm going to tell you about is that the chromatograph, not only is it impossible for you to understand unless you're a chemist, and even for a lot of chemists, they don't understand essential oil chemistry, okay? The most problematic part of all of this is that the chromatograph isn't even going to show you a lot of things. It's only going to show you the gross adulterants, and that file that I just referred you to has gross adulterants in it. So, here's another one. Essential oils last forever. All right, well, here's a good one. Let's talk about shelf life. This is very practical and very important, and also a good way to protect ourselves. The way that I classify essential oil shelf life is into three levels. Number one, citrus oils tend to oxidize the fastest. They have the shortest shelf life. Most essential oils that are high-quality oils generally will have a shelf life of 5 to 10 years, especially if you keep them sealed out of sun, and especially if you refrigerate them, actually. Then there is one group of essential oils that actually gets better with age. All right, now, in order to understand this, we need to look at, well, how do oils degrade? Do essential oils ferment? That's one way that things degrade. they ferment. No, why? Because fermentation is a bacterial consumption of sugar in water. All right, there has to be water, there has to be bacteria, there has to be sugar. That's what fermentation is. So essential oils don't have water in them. They separate out from the water, as you saw in the slideshow last week in the distillation process. There's no water. So essential oils are actually used as preservatives against fermentation. And this is one of the reasons why the hydrosols have a fairly long shelf life, is because they still have the aromatic molecules in them, protecting them from fermentation. Now, the other way that things degrade is through rancidity. Do essential oils go rancid? No, they do not. That's because rancidity is oxygenation degradation of fatty molecules. However, this is a big problem, because you may find that after some time you open your bottle of essential oil and it smells rancid. Well, how did that happen? There's a carrier oil. Your nice rose oil or jasmine oil or sandalwood oil was stretched with a carrier oil. That's one of the things we're going to look at here in a minute in terms of quality control. Lots of essential oils have carrier oils added to them that degrade over time. All right, the main problem that we have to be concerned with is oxidizing. And the citrus oils will tend to oxidize the fastest, but many other essential oils can oxidize, and in the process of oxidizing, they become more sensitizing to the skin, and people have more adverse reactions to them. So this is one of the reasons that has been found why tea tree oil is frequently very irritating and dermotoxic to the skin, is they suspect that it's because a lot of the oil that's on the market has just been sitting around too long. It's oxidized. That can happen to flower oils like lavender. That explains why some people have adverse reactions to lavender oil. So citrus oils, make sure you just use them up. That's the simple solution. Use them within a relatively short period of time. If you want to keep them the longest and make sure that they have the least likelihood of breaking down, keep them in the refrigerator. You can keep all your essential oils in the refrigerator. I don't advise that you freeze them, but you can keep them in the refrigerator. That will extend their shelf life considerably. Now, there's a group of oils that get better and better with age. It is not true that essential oils last for thousands of years. That's another myth. People are trying to say that essential oils were around during the time of Jesus. It's not true that they were around during the Egyptian pharaohs. It's not true. There were aromatic preparations that were around, but they weren't doing distillation then, because they weren't doing aromatic plant distillation until about 700 years ago. They were distilling alcohol, they were distilling other things, but there is no evidence so far that they were distilling aromatic plants until the Arabs started doing it about 1400. Okay, that's a little bit of historical reference there for you. Now, there's one other thing that, a couple other points here before we move on to adverse reactions. Should I use an oil if I don't like it? Well, this is a little bit complicated. Some people, there's a myth around this, some misunderstanding, which says that if you don't like it, it's good for you. That's really more in the department of herbal medicine, all right? If you have an infection in the throat, yes, you should take some golden seal powder, and you should gargle with it and swallow it. It tastes terrible, but it's going to help you. Now, the difference is that essential oils work through different channels. They work through the limbic system with aromatherapy through our sense of smell. Therefore, if there's something that we really don't like, a lot of times that can actually influence the outcome of it. Fragrance can make us feel emotionally upset because of emotional associations and memories. This is something that I think would be best if we just unpack it as we go a step at a time, because a lot of oils, the way they work, is highly subjective. For those oils where there's no subjectivity involved, then the answer might be yes. Like, for example, if you have a soft tissue injury, you should put helichrysum oil on it. Absolutely. What if you don't like the fragrance? Use it anyway. What about Jatamansi? It stinks. A lot of people don't like the fragrance of it. This is one oil that I tell them to use it anyway. Just try it anyway. And usually what happens is once they use it, they get a good result. They start sleeping better. Their association with it becomes positive, and they actually start to like it. All right. A few other things here. There's a myth that that essential oils are hydrating. Not true. Essential oils dry the skin. They burn the mucous membranes of the GI tract. I gave an example of three oils that are potentially hydrating because they're very, very viscous. Those are rosin, sandalwood, and vetiver. Okay, let's see. I think that's probably enough. One more very important thing here. A lot of people are being told that essential oils can be used directly on babies. Don't do that. We have a whole module that's dedicated to essential oil use for children, elderly, and specialized medical conditions. But I'll just say right off, don't use essential oils on babies, okay? There may be some specialized ways of very low dilution in a diffuser, but just stay away from that for now, all right? Another myth, you can't have a bad reaction to a pure oil. I already touched on that. So, all right, let's move on now. Quality control issues. I'll spend a few minutes on this, a few minutes on adverse effects. If you open the file titled Adulteration and Contamination, please. Let's take a look at that file. This is just a lot of bad news. But you need to know. That is my responsibility, is to educate. And since we're in a very problematic industry, much more so than herbal medicine, I don't touch on these subjects in the herbal medicine course because there are so many companies that are selling high quality products, and adulteration and contamination is much less of an issue. In the essential oil industry, it's really bad. So here's a list of things that you need to be aware of. In the United States, the term pure has no legal meaning. It's applied to just about everything. Lots of synthetic fragrances are found. This is very dangerous when people are being told to take something internally, especially. A lot of the more exotic floral fragrances, honeysuckle, gardenia, frangipani, these types of things are never found in essential oil form. Sometimes you can find a pure absolute that has been extracted with some type of solvent, but these are very rare and extremely expensive. What you mostly find on the shelf is synthetic. So if somebody is telling you, take this flower oil internally, don't. It's not an oil. Adulteration. The more expensive the oil, the more the risk of adulteration. I already explained that. Some oils are highly adulterated, like lemon balm and sandalwood. Big risk. You must know each oil in terms of whether there's a risk for adulteration. Something like eucalyptus oil is produced in such large amounts, and the trees are not endangered. We don't have to worry about those kind of things. It's when the plant is endangered, like sandalwood, or when there's a very low yield, like lemon balm, that's why there's a risk of adulteration, is because it takes so much plant material to get a tiny bit of oil. Same problem with helichrysum. You must also understand the chain of supply. I've touched on this. Lots of levels of buyers and suppliers, and the more levels that are involved, the more the risk of adulteration. And lots of oils are sold to companies as genuine and pure. And the companies don't know. So there's rampant false advertising, all right? The solution is get it directly from the distiller, and that's what we do. Pesticides are mostly carried over in the expressing of the oils from citrus peels, all right? A lot of pesticides don't carry over in the distillation process, so that's not an issue. However, if you have certification that the distiller is not only has a certified organic distillery, but that their crops are certified organic or wild harvested as well. Another problem is that low-grade oils are sold as higher. So if you're a company, what are you going to do? Tell people that you're selling a low-grade oil? No. You're going to say this is rare and exotic, top grade. You're going to mark it up. Lots of oils are extended. That means adding natural solvents. A lot of things have jojoba oil in them, like I said. You're going to notice that after a year or two. It's going to go rancid, okay? Bulking. That means that they put a lot of different species into the still to get more oil out. Rectified and redistilled and folded and reconstituted. So many things are done. Now, this is at the industrial level. This doesn't happen if you're dealing with ethical artisan distillers who really care about their products. This happens at the big industrial level. That's what we want to stay away from. Why is this important? Because low-quality contaminated oils cause adverse reactions to yourself and others. So all companies, to answer this question again, all companies have some good oils. But the larger the company, the harder it is to keep the oils in stock. They're going to go to the brokers. The lower the yield, the more it's in demand, the more the species is threatened, the more the risk of adulteration. All right. Now, there's a couple different ways around that. A company can invest in very expensive testing equipment, not just a chromatograph, but spectrometry as well. You can spend easily $250,000 just to get analytical equipment, and then you have to have a highly trained chemist who knows essential oils to test everything. Even that is not going to show you everything. That's one route. Another way that you can be, you can feel some confidence is that there are third-party certifying agencies. Now, most of the really good distillers, really professional, ethical distillers, producing high-quality organic essential oils from organic sources, have several levels of certification. That includes organizations like EcoCert. There's many independent testing organizations. And the more of these certificates that a person has, the more confident you can feel. All right. There's also organic certification here in the United States from the USDA. So that's another level of confidence or knowing about the quality. But at the retail level, what do you as a retail consumer have to protect you? Very little, actually. You don't know. There's a few things to watch for. Watch for pricing indicators. In other words, if you're there shopping and the product line and everything is like $5, forget it. Essential oils are really becoming expensive. It's something that we have to deal with every time we get a new shipment. The prices have gone up. The demand is increasing. The availability is declining. The cost of production is increasing. The entire time that I have worked in this industry, which is over 10 years, I have never seen the price of an oil go down. It only goes up and up and up. So that's one indicator. True high-quality oils are very expensive, but that's not going to tell you, you know, maybe somebody's just gouging. Maybe somebody's selling something as pure and it's not. Watch for terms like fragrance compound. If it says fragrance compound, it's not a real oil. All right. The solution that we have adopted as a business is that we know our distillers. Sarah and I have been there. You can see videos of these people. We've worked with them. We've gone harvesting with them. We've put the plants in the still. We see the oil coming out of the still. That's the only way you know. That's the model of business that we have. We have an extended network, extended family of artisan distillers. We know our supply chain. That's the answer. Some people have already asked me that. But there's another answer to this, and this is a much bigger question for the long term. How are we even going to be getting a lot of these oils in the future? I would like to suggest that those of you who are seriously interested in natural medicine start thinking about community gardens, growing a lot of herbs for yourself or your home pharmacy. And as part of that, you can start doing small-scale distillation in your backyard or in your community garden. You're not going to get a lot of essential oil, but you will get a lot of hydrosol, and that's very, very therapeutic and effective also. All right, now, there are a few simple tests. I just want to mention these. I don't think they're all that reliable, but there's a couple of things you can do. You can put a drop of essential oil on a clean white piece of blotting paper, in other words, a tester strip. Now, most essential oils that are light solvent consistency should evaporate completely. This isn't very reliable for a lot of the other oils that are thicker and more viscous, like vetiver oil is going to be there forever. But some of a lot of the oils like eucalyptus and things like that, it's a fairly easy method. It should just evaporate completely. There shouldn't be any staining with this. That's one simple home method. Another is to put a drop of the essential oil in a glass of water. If it becomes discolored, turns milky, it's probably got some kind of emulsifier in it. The essential oil should basically just float as a little drop on the top. It shouldn't discolor the water. And you can also compare viscosity. You put a drop on your fingers and rub them together. And you should not be able to feel any oiliness to most essential oils. Now, really, the best test, and this is why I'm asking all of you to do the practice of contemplative aromatherapy, is that really we have to learn how to identify the body sensations, trust our own pranic intelligence to tell us, is this pure or not? Most of the time, we can tell the difference between something that's blatantly adulterated or highly synthetic and a pure essential oil. But in order to learn that, you have to become sensitive, you have to pay attention, and you have to study a wide range of oils also. So please just go ahead and start doing that. Now, I want to point out one last piece of bad news here, and then we're going to move on into the positive side. And I hope that you appreciate that I'm taking the time to warn you about these things. Because if you're going to get involved in essential oils, there's no way around it. This is what's happening. If you would please open the file called Adverse Effects and Injury Reports. Adverse Effect Report. Okay. Now, this comes from a link that you can see here from the Atlantic Institute of Aromatherapy. I'd like to say thank you to them for starting this collecting of adverse reports, which has been going on now for a couple of years. And this is a report from 6 months in 2015. And in a six-month period of time last year, there were 133 reports of adverse reactions. Now, I imagine that is a minuscule fraction of the number of adverse reactions that happened. And the reason for that is because the majority of people who had them probably didn't know that there was even a place to report them. So I would estimate, on the conservative side, thousands and thousands of adverse reactions happened in that six-month period. So this is 133 reports, and they're basically broken down. And this is for your benefit, not just to know that there's widespread adverse reactions, but also to let you know what adverse reactions look like. You can study this in more detail at that link, and you can also, there's quite a number of files that are there to download. I just want to bring it to your attention. But they broke it down here into during the use and immediately after the use of the essential oil. So the site was irritated and inflamed. It caused boils and blisters and sores, burning sensation, cold sweats, chills, coughing, gagging. It caused cysts. It caused cognitive dysfunction, anxiety, irritability, delusions, diarrhea, fever, GI upset, nausea, seizures. Seizures? All right. That's how serious this is, okay? And I do know that is happening. People are being hospitalized. It's pretty serious. Now, those effects continue on afterwards. Serious allergic reaction, anaphylaxis, okay? Bladder dysfunction, difficulty breathing and shortness of breath, headaches, heart attack. Well, this is something that I personally heard about. Somebody reported to me personally that their father went to a raindrop therapy session where they had the hot, spicy dermotoxic oils applied all over their spine. They walked out of there and had a heart attack. Coincidence? I don't know. I'm not going to make any statements about it, but that was something that was reported. Okay, so this is serious. Let's take it seriously. Let's be very, very careful. Let's not practice unsafe uses of essential oils, please. Let's be very careful with how we use them. So now, let's learn how to do that. Please open the file called Using Essential Oils. This file will now help us avoid all of those problems. The practice of aromatherapy is nothing more than taking a huge amount of plant material, distilling it down into a highly concentrated substance that is not biocompatible, and then diluting it back into a form that is biocompatible. And all the problems and all those scary adverse reactions we just looked at all come because people are not diluting it back to a biocompatible form. If we dilute the oil to a biocompatible form, it's okay. It can be used by everybody safely. Home pharmacy, grassroots healthcare, folk medicine. Therapeutic benefits are immense. But if we're using them in highly concentrated form, and especially if we're telling people to take them internally, extremely dangerous. Okay, now, inhalations. You can put the essential oils on a hot compress. You can inhale it from there. You can put it in diffusers. You can put it on hot water. Standard dose, 10 drops. Why? Because it's diluted. If you put 10 drops on a hot compress with water, it's diluted. If you put 10 drops on a pot of hot water, it's okay. It's diluted. If you put it in a steam bath, it's diluted. Now, this way of using essential oils is best for the respiratory system and for the sinuses and for headaches, but a word of warning, don't burn your eyes. Don't put 10 drops of Tulsi oil. Be reasonable here. Don't put 10 drops of Tulsi oil or cinnamon oil on a pot of hot water, cover your head with a towel, and then start breathing in and keep your eyes open. You'll burn yourself. 10 drops maximum, okay? 5 drops is better. Start with 1 or 2. See how it feels. Again, more warnings and cautions. Prolonged inhalation can cause headaches and dizziness. So be reasonable here with the direct inhalation from steam, okay? Another method is you can put a couple drops of most oils on your palms, rub them together, and breathe them. You can do that with most of the oils that have low dermotoxic potential that are good for the sinuses and lungs. You can do it with eucalyptus oils. You can do it with the conifers. You can do it with most of the flower oils. Okay, now, bath. This is a little bit complicated because oil and water doesn't mix. If you put 10 drops of a strong essential oil on the water and then you get in it, it's going to burn your skin. So this is maximum of low dermotoxic potential oils. May I suggest that for the bath that you stick to 2 basic groups of oils. The respiratory oils, meaning eucalyptus and conifers, and you use them in the bath for your respiratory system, or the flower oils for relaxation. If you use those 2 groups of oils, 5 to 10 drops is fine. Disperse it, and emulsify it. That's even better. Put the oil into some milk, mix it around, pour it into the bath. Or you can mix it in salt. That will disperse it. We're going to cover more about these methods of applications as we get into the therapeutic categories. But aromatic baths are very good for skin problems, circulatory problems, respiratory problems, stress and nervous tension, insomnia, muscular pains, menstrual pains. Lots of benefits, all right? So just use the mild, non-irritating oils, please. Okay, compresses, you can put the oil into the water, soak a cloth, wrap it, put it on an area. Good for bruises, wounds, muscular aches. Facial steam, very good for opening the sinuses. It's also good for your skin, for the face, for some types of oils and treatments. Just be careful, don't burn your eyes. And the common, most recommended dilutions for massage oil are here, okay? So typical dilutions are typically 2 to 10%. What does that mean? 2% means 12 drops in an ounce of carrier oil. Okay, now this is just the first overview. Now let's look at carrier oils here, and then it's going to be time to sign off. If you open the file on carrier oils, this is a lot to study. This is more of a reference for you because you're going to want to know about the different carrier oils. And all the different carrier oils have quite a bit of information. One of the most important is how long is the shelf life. You want to make sure that it's not going rancid, because if you use rancid oils, it's not good for the skin. On the other hand, you also want to know the fragrance level. If you have a very strong smelling oil, it's going to overpower the beautiful, expensive rose oil that you got, and you're going to lose it. You're going to lose that fragrance. So this is something we can unpack a bit more. I'm going to take a little bit of time with this next week, but take some time and just read through this now to become familiar with the basic idea of what are some of these different oils good for, what is their fragrance intensity, how thick are they, are they colored or not? This is a good place to just get an overview for those of you who are in the 7 week. This is a review, but we're going to be using this quite a bit as we move forward now, because we're going to be making different kinds of recipes. All right. There's one more file that is very important. That's called Toxicology and Safety. Now, this is a more extended version of how to use the essential oils. So please take some time, become familiar with it. I'm going to review it next week. Don't take the oils internally. Don't put them directly on the skin. Keep them away from children. Avoid contact with eyes and mucous membranes. On and on. This is your full list. And then I unpack it further. Don't apply it to the skin. Well, there's some exceptions to that. And again, you're going to see the exact ratios with carrier oils. There's a section here on skin type, skin reactions, different types, irritation, sensitizing, phototoxicity. We need to know all of that. We need to know why to keep it away from the mucous membranes. And one of the saddest things that I've come across recently is that people were told to put essential oils in their eyes. Not very intelligent. Okay? You want to avoid synthetic fragrances. You want to avoid exposure without, long-term exposure without good ventilation. Proper storage, general advice. All right, please read through this. This is a little bit of your homework. And let's see. You have one other file called Absorption and Diffusers. Four primary methods of absorption, glandular absorption. That happens through the brain when we breathe it, and through the skin a little bit. Skin absorption, respiratory absorption, and circulatory absorption, which is basically both through the skin and the respiratory. A little bit of information here about diffusers. I'll spend a little bit of time with this next week to unpack this. Just go ahead and read through this. And so that is everything. And your deepening practice, I didn't make a specific file for your deepening practice here, so I'm just going to go ahead and mention it. Continue with your practice of contemplative aromatherapy. Study all of these files. Be very aware of the complexities of all of these subjects. You can find a lot of information to follow up with this if you like. And if any of you have had some adverse reactions with essential oils or some stories to tell about it, you can go ahead and you can post things to the webcast. And so, with that, I'm going to wind things down, and I'm going to say thank you again for being in this course. I hope you find this valuable information. Again, this was kind of moving through all the bad news, but it's setting up the foundation now for the rest of the course for us to understand the powers and the possible dangers of essential oils so we proceed in an educated way, wisely. And so with that, I'll say have a good week, and I will talk to you next week, and we will continue unpacking some of these subjects a little bit, and then we're going to move into the bigger subjects of classifying the essential oils into larger botanical therapeutic categories, and that's where we move step by step into how we actually use these oils for our therapeutic benefits. So have a good week. I'll talk to you next week, and Colleen, I'll turn it back to you.
Well, isn't that wonderful? Thank you, David, wherever you are, flying in an airplane at the moment, and so much gratitude for this full, rich session.